This is KYUK, public radio for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. I'm Evan Erickson. It's been 3 weeks since one of the schools in Aniak was abruptly closed due to structural concerns in the gymnasium. Now, the Kuskokwim School District says it has prepared for the worst. On Wednesday, the district hosted a meeting at the Aniak Community Hall. Administrators told families that the community hall is the designated evacuation point if the gym roof at its 6th to 12th grade school suddenly collapses. The district says more than 10 tons of building materials recently arrived in Aniak and that a construction crew is currently working on scaffolding to shore up and protect the gym roof. The gym was closed in early January after people reported that it was actively cracking open and that the majority of the wooden supporting joists had snapped, according to Superintendent Madeline Aguillard. In mid-January, Aguillard says a structural engineer recommended that the gym be demolished and said it was unsafe to occupy the junior and senior high school altogether. The roughly 50 displaced students are currently taking classes alongside younger peers in the attached elementary school. Over the past weeks, the district says staff have been doing evacuation drills so students can practice reaching the community hall and are accounted for in the case of an emergency. Aguillard told community members at Wednesday's meeting that she is confident the district can maintain classes for Aniak's roughly 100 total students, even if its newly built elementary school is deemed unsafe to occupy. She says that the district office has ample space and that the local Native Corporation has offered up use of an old elementary school as well. The district said its final action plan will depend on what a team of engineers and the district's insurer find next week during their visit to Aniak. Aguillard says it has been a tough situation. The schools are more than just buildings, and this closure has come at the heart of basketball season and left a lot of academic and community events up in the air. It was only supposed to last for 4 hours, but Tuesday's hearing on a controversial proposal to reform the Federal Subsistence Board went for 6 hours and 33 minutes. Every person who signed up to testify, both online and at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife headquarters in Anchorage, got a chance to speak. Even though more than 100 people weighed in, it's far from the last word in this debate. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, most were from rural communities that depend on hunting and fishing to put food on the table.
The battle over who manages subsistence on federal lands is an old one in Alaska that basically pits two groups against each other: those who subsist to survive and those who hunt and fish for sport and recreation. Safari Club International is one of the nation's largest wildlife advocacy groups, which promotes conservation and the freedom to hunt and fish. It has proposed some major changes to how subsistence would be managed on federal lands in Alaska.
To say that the proposed changes are anti-subsistence is simply not correct.
John Sturgeon, a longtime leader of Safari Club's Alaska chapter, says the Federal Subsistence Board has drifted far beyond its original intent, has ignored the rule of law, and failed to make protecting fish and wildlife its highest priority.
Specifically, the protection of wildlife must always come first. I've heard people say today, subsistence has to come first. Protection of wildlife has to come first. If there's not wildlife, if there's not fish, you're not going to have subsistence.
The Safari Club wants to remove 6 public and tribal seats from the board, change how the Rural Advisory Council members are selected, and wants the board to defer to the state of Alaska when they disagree on management decisions. The Federal Subsistence Board was created after the state failed to comply with the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, legislation Congress passed in 1980 that mandated a rural priority for subsistence. It originally included only the heads of 5 federal agencies.
We strongly believe that the people who use the land need to be making the decisions about the land.
Gloria Burns is president of the Ketchikan Indian Community, one of many tribal leaders who came from across the state to protest the proposed changes.
What we have noticed throughout the years as we've watched, as we had the addition of the 3 public seats and then the 3 tribal seats, there was a strengthening of the scope and the ability.
With only 60 days allotted for public comment, the February 13th deadline is fast approaching. Tribal leaders say this time frame is too short to weigh in on something so critical to the rural and native way of life. Kara Moriarty, the Interior Department's senior advisor for Alaska Affairs, reminded the crowd that this review was prompted not by the Safari Club, but by President Trump, who ordered an evaluation of all government departments.
The scoping period is just solely to gather information at this point. No decisions have been made whether to make any changes to the program at all.
Moriarty says the next step will be for the Secretaries of Interior and Agriculture to consider the testimony.
If the secretaries determine they would like to make any changes, an official rulemaking process would begin at a future date.
Moriarty says after the scoping period closes, there's no requirement for the secretaries to take any action at all. The Safari Club hopes they'll decide to put the state back in the driver's seat of fish and wildlife management, an administrative workaround to the state's failure to pass a constitutional amendment that would allow for the rural priority required by ANILCA. Kyle Tripp, president of the Alaska Safari Club, says the Federal Subsistence Board needs to be reined in.
That priority remains federal law. However, Department of Interior must ensure the Federal Subsistence Board operates transparently within its lawful authority and grounded in sound science rather than politics.
I speak today not only for myself, but for the families who depend on this land and these animals. Not for their recreation or profit, but for survival, culture, and continuity.
Matt Anderstrom is the food sovereignty coordinator for the Yakutat tribe. He objects to the Safari Club's proposal to change how Rural Advisory Council members are selected, a plan he says would open the door to commercial interests.
I want to be clear. RACs are often the only place where local subsistence voices are heard at all. Weakening them would silence the very people ANILCA was written to protect.
There is one thing both sides agree upon, the three-minute limit on public testimony.
3 minutes is too short. It's an insult.
Joe Williams is the tribal president for Saxman. He urged Moriarty and other Interior Department leaders to visit villages and hear firsthand from those who would be hurt by these proposals. As he handed Moriarty and her staff jars of smoked salmon, he said an entire way of life is at stake.
And hope to come to know you, but this is what we do.
Throughout the hearing, Moriarty apologized profusely for the time limit, but said there was no other way to include as many voices as possible. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Alaska's state government remains in search of a solution to its long-running budget problems. The problem is simple. The state spends more than it takes in. The solution, well, not so simple. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports.
If you ask Governor Mike Dunleavy, a lot of the state's problems come back to the budget process. Every year, lawmakers gather in Juneau for 4 months and spend much of that time debating how the state should spread around its limited funds. How much for education, how much for public safety, and for the last decade or so, how much the permanent fund dividend should be. Meanwhile, much of the state's revenue depends on the constantly swinging price of oil. Dunleavy says investors who might otherwise bring jobs and new residents to the state have noticed.
This volatile budgetary process has negatively impacted our ability to recruit investment to the state. It has retarded our GDP growth. It has caused deep fractures within this body and within other relationships. And it leads to uncertainty in funding for critical programs.
He said that in his State of the State speech, days before filing a series of bills outlining a fiscal plan that he says would make the budget more stable by boosting revenue and cutting expenses. Most of the money it would raise would come from a sales tax, 4% in the summer, 2% in the winter. The plan would also hike oil taxes and capture more money from outside businesses. It would all be temporary, 5 to 7 years, and at the end, corporate income taxes would vanish entirely. On the expense side, it would put a 1% cap on state spending growth every year. That is not adjusted for inflation, so if inflation runs more than 1%, state spending shrinks. And it would also take the permanent fund dividend out of the state's annual budget debates by putting it and a new formula into the state constitution. Plug that into the state budget and, well,
at no point do any of these things add up to get to a balanced budget.
Neil Steininger crunched the numbers for the Alaska Political Report, an insider-y subscription newsletter. It probably helps that he's a former budget director for Dunleavy. Steininger says, for one thing, Dunleavy's plan would fully drain the state's $3 billion rainy day fund by 2033 or 2034, not exactly resolving the state's budget issues. But for another thing, Steininger says the effect of the changes would ultimately make the state's revenue just as volatile, if not more, exactly what Dunleavy is trying to avoid. As a result of Dunleavy's proposed formula for dividends, which would take half of the state's annual draw from the permanent fund and split it 50-50 between state services and dividends. Steininger says the fact that so much reliable, stable investment revenue would be tied to dividends would make the state more dependent on the price of oil.
That's a position we've been in already. You know, that's actually nothing new. It's just really cementing that into the Constitution.
The governor has repeatedly declined interviews on his plans, but his projections are substantially rosier. They show a slight surplus in the early 2030s before returning to large deficits. But the governor's office still projects the plan would draw down half of the rainy day fund over 10 years. Dunleavy says revenue from things like a boom in oil drilling or a new gas pipeline would help the budget balance in the long term. But Steininger says those don't show up in state economists' projections. And so far, the plan has landed in Juneau with a thud. Speaker of the House Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent, says he's not optimistic about its chances.
Back of the envelope would suggest that the governor's plan in its totality would actually increase our problem. It would not lessen it.
Even Dunleavy's traditional allies are skeptical. The Republican House Minority Leader called his plan incomplete. But where does that leave state leaders' search for a solution? Edgman and his Senate counterpart say they're intrigued by what they recently heard from a panel of University of Alaska Anchorage economists. They studied a wide variety of options at the request of the governor. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, says he was interested in the economists' conclusion that raising taxes on corporations and oil and gas would have the smallest impact on the state's economy.
The impact on people, it's much more stressful on folks to have a sales tax or an income tax, easier to accumulate a little higher tax on the industry.
But in the last year of Dunleavy's term, Stephen says it might be too late for this governor to solve the problem. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
This is KYUK News. I'm Evan Erickson. Koyana for listening. Please share your news tips, comments, or suggestions. You can email us at news@kyuk.org or message us on Facebook. And stay tuned for Yogtun Ganomchit.